Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. And as you know, gold and silver have been taking a beating lately, and the airwaves and print media, at least in the West, are full of stories about how the gold bull run is over and that it's headed back to the basement, presumably forever. And yet we here at Peak Prosperity remain steadfast in our view that gold's long, unbroken history of winning battles against mismanaged and overprinted currencies will turn in a repeat performance in the near future. To understand gold, well beyond the simple and distorted views promoted by a financial system that has deep conflicts of interest on the subject, you need to understand its history, what money really is and truly does for a society, and a little bit of human psychology to grasp why fiat money unerringly loses value over time, sometimes catastrophically. To help us go deeper and understand why gold remains the very best store of value, especially in these times, is Nick Barashev, the president and CEO of Bullion Management Group, and author of the newly released book, $10,000 Gold, Why Gold's Inevitable Rise is the Investor's Safe Haven. Nick Barashev has focused on the world of precious metals and the advantages of investing in gold, silver, and platinum bullion for over a decade. And in 2002, interestingly, he launched BMG and BMG Bullion Fund, Canada's only retirement savings plan eligible open-end mutual fund trust that invests directly in gold, silver, and platinum bullion, which means he knows how to navigate the sophisticated, complex, and sometimes arcane worlds of financial products and regulations. Welcome, Nick. I know I'm going to enjoy this conversation.
Well, I'm pleased to be on your show, Chris, and it's good talking to you again.
Fantastic. Well, let's start with a punchline and then go deeper to understand it better. Your book is titled with the idea of gold going to $10,000. Now, of course, you certainly penned that title before the recent pummeling of gold in April of 2013. Would you change the title if you could pen it today?
Absolutely not. And normally in the past, like I've as you mentioned, you know, started the fund, you know, way back to 2002, and actually it took 4 years before then to get regulatory approval. So I've been doing this ever since. And although I knew gold was rising, I was reluctant to, you know, to put a number and a time frame. And when I say $10,000 gold, I don't mean this year or even next year. It's probably a plus or minus 5 year scenario. But what changed my mind was in 2011, when in the U.S. there was the raging debate over the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And when you listen to that, like, first of all, the gold price went up 30% in the 3 months during, you know, preceding and during the debate, because then by having the debate, the deep problems that the debt ceiling represented were debated on, you know, on the media, like, virtually daily. And when you looked at that, you could see that there was no political will or ability to ever change that. And because it's impossible to either increase taxes, you know, or cut expenditures enough to really make a difference. And you know, you're not going to grow your way out of it. Nobody's predicting that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the only choice left is essentially, you know, in simplified terms, to call it printing. And when you look at that, then what you get is that the printing is going to continue, the deficits are going to continue, and in fact, they're going to increase. And the interesting point is that if you plot U.S. debt versus the gold price, you almost get perfect correlation.
Hmm.
So this is just a straight progression. Like, if you keep printing at the rate you're printing, you're going to get to 10,000. 10,000 is by no means the peak, and people have trouble coming to grips with 10,000. But if you hit 10,000, and then we're into hyperinflation, and the numbers after that will sound absurd.
And so I want to talk about that history, because you're mentioning something that's happened time and time again, which is a country gets a little overextended and decides that printing is the way out. And of course, that's happened a lot. Now, in your book, you talk about that there are five stages that irredeemable fiat currencies seem to go through. And I think that's a really helpful framework for people to understand. First, that this has happened time and time again, whether the coinage was debased by actually pulling it in and replacing the precious metal content with copper, or later on it was actual physical paper printing, or today you punch a few keyboard strokes and next thing you know you've got extra zeros showing up on in credit balances in various institutions. Walk us through those stages. Stage one, what is that?
Well, I don't know if we have enough time to go through the stages, but I think that the important thing there to know is that throughout all of history, there has never been a single instance where a fiat currency didn't end in hyperinflation and complete collapse. There isn't one example of a successful fiat currency. Because the simple issue is that if you give a printing press in simplified terms to a politician, a king, an emperor, a president, a prime minister, you name it, they will overuse it every single time. That's just human nature. And that's what happens. It's, you know, partially a deficiency in democracy, because democracy will also always have people vote themselves a bunch of benefits that the politicians promise to get elected. And that's how you get this spiral effect that keeps going. So the end result is the same. This time around, though, we're in uncharted territory, because you've got global fiat currencies and you've got a global reserve currency. So unlike hyperinflations in the past, like everybody knows about Germany, it was restricted to a country. This time it's going to be global.
Well, global, and I noticed in your five stages that it's just basically walking through the process of going from first trying out an unbacked fiat currency and everything seems fine for a while, and then it gets overused and abused. And so today, I would note that there are certain proponents on the monetary side, maybe the Paul Krugman, Ben Bernanke side, who are claiming that not only have we not overprinted, and not only are deficits not a big deal, but we actually haven't gone far enough. Where do you fall in that story? Could they be right?
Well, in terms of the short term, there's probably no other choice but to print more, because we'd have if the Fed pulled back in its current quantitative easing, we'd have a massive depression. So for the moment, you print more, but the problem is what happens down the road. That's the point. So when the results happen, Greenspan's already retired. Ben Bernanke may be retired by then. And then you have the consequences. But for the moment, this keeps the ship afloat and the pain minimized for the time being.
Well, so let's walk down this road, because I want to understand what happens here. I think it's essential to getting to $10,000 gold. So ultimately, I guess the final moment a currency finally losing its value, if people experience it as inflation and they talk about it as rising prices, but in fact what's happening, as I understand it, maybe you could help add some light to this or correct me if I've got this wrong, but the things that have real value retain that value, and what happens is the amount of currency gets reset against that. So all we're talking about is a great reset, where if there's $1 trillion outstanding but there's only $1 billion worth of stuff out there, suddenly it looks like that stuff costs $1 trillion.
That's right.
All right.
So what's happening now in terms of gold? It's not that gold price is rising because, you know, of jewelry demand or something. It's the currencies all over the world are depreciating as measured in gold. So gold looks to be rising because you can't tell the currencies are depreciating, because they're all depreciating at plus or minus the same pace, but all against gold. So it looks like gold is rising in all currencies, but all of them are overprinting.
Well, now let's talk about the recent price action of gold? Because, of course, as I mentioned before, there's plenty in the airwaves right now to suggest that the gold bull run is over. There was this extraordinary takedown of gold price in April, which, of course, there's been no investigation of it. It's been presented as if that was normal market action. But it was a historic event in the sense that we hadn't seen a similar swan dive in over 30 years. What was your take on that? You probably had a pretty front lines view of that, and I'd just be interested to have your observations on what happened there.
Well, I think the starting point there is I tend to not think of gold as an investment. I mean, if anything, it's an anti-investment. You're choosing not to invest. But when I talk about that kind of gold, that's bullion in a vault, okay? Mm-hmm. And whether you have bullion in a vault or a stack of Swiss francs or a stack of euros or whatever, they're not invested. They're just sitting in the vault.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're sitting in the vault, you're not going to get any interest or dividends. So that myth about gold doesn't pay any interest or dividends applies to any currency. Mm-hmm. You put it in a vault, stack it, you're not getting any interest or dividends. So I don't consider that gold, you know, was in a bull market to begin with. Because it's not like, you know, copper or zinc or the equity markets where they are investments. And some of the paper proxies and derivatives of gold are investments. But, you know, physical bullion in a vault, you know, coins, that you hold in your possession and so on and so forth, that's just money. Everything else is a debt-based currency. What happens is that people always say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, gold's an archaic relic. You know, we have all this modern digital stuff. Well, I say, well, why don't you go and read the U.S. governments, the Canadian governments, any other government you choose, and see what they think is that. So if you look under assets, you'll have monetary assets. And when you go to the footnote to see what monetary assets are, there are foreign currency reserves and gold. So obviously the governments around the world, the central banks, understand that gold is a monetary asset. They don't call it jewelry, okay? But they promote it to everyone else as if it's not money. But it's the only thing that is money. Everything else is a debt-based currency. So when you start from there, then it becomes clear that the currencies are losing value against real money gold. And the paper side, the derivative side, whether it's the COMEX futures contracts, the GLD ETFs and, you know, options and all the rest of it, those are investment. They're momentum trades, they're so on. But gold in a vault, that's just money that isn't invested.
Well, so one of the things I've observed about lots of markets, gold and silver are included in this, but there are other markets that I've seen this happen in as well, oil, certain equities, all kinds of things, is that the way the market is structured right now, there are insiders or certain participants have different advantages than you or I might. And I noted that way back in January, there was already what I would call a psychological campaign to start talking gold down. You had some of the big bullion banks and research houses starting to talk about how gold had topped, and then they all started accumulating these large short positions, and then in the media there was this really sort of amplification over time. And then by the time we went from January through to April, we were ripe for a fall at that point in time, simply because there was this is, I believe, how many big traders make their money. This is a wash, rinse, repeat sort of a thing. I've seen these bear raids many times in the past, and sure. And they do it because they make money at it.
Right. Well, but it's also facilitated by the rules, and one of the issues is that you're essentially allowed naked shorting, you know, on the COMEX, which is illegal in the financial markets. Okay, so this is where you get these kind of distortions, because you can create the kind of events that happened, you know, in April by selling an unbelievable amount, like the estimates are up to 400 tons of futures contracts when you have no gold to begin with. So that's where the flaw comes in. And the COMEX has limits on in terms of how much you can sell, which is supposed to be restricted to 3,000 contracts. So although we don't have the data, either 14 traders traded 3,000 contracts at exactly the same time each on exactly the same day, or one trader did 30,000 contracts.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Friday. So when you allow that, then you're going to have massive distortions in the paper price as a result, because it's like starting a snowball. You start with that, but then right after that, you're triggering stops, and following that, you're triggering margin calls. And then the selling kind of continues, and the price keeps dropping. In this case, the first time is the reverse happened in the physical markets. It went the other way. The premiums went up. So if you look at the prices in many cases with premiums added in, the price didn't change.
For what sorts of products?
Well, coins, and it didn't include the largest bars, but primarily for the coins, and in terms of people actually, you know, there was no lineups at the coin shops of people selling their physical bullion. There was lineups trying to buy, and the coin shops quickly ran out. The mint ran out, both the Canadian and the U.S. mint, you know, got instantly backlogged. So this is kind of where you've got, when you have this kind of distorted paper price to the physical price. And I've always said that this was going to happen, like, in a much bigger way sooner or later. But it's already happened. Like, going back to, I don't know if you remember, in 1998, Ford Motor Company bought $1 billion worth of palladium.
Yeah.
In a private transaction at twice the prevailing spot price. Because you can't build cars or catalytic converters with paper palladium. So there is a difference.
Yep.
The same thing happened. China bought potash a few years ago at twice the price. And also China entered into a long-term contract with Russia for oil at $75 a barrel when the price was 37. So that's where you get the examples of the difference between the physical asset and the paper speculation on proxies and derivatives.
So you're saying one of the end stage events will be divorcing of the paper price that we see at COMEX and the physical price required to actually obtain it, if you can. And we certainly saw this, I think, you know, one of the things we observed down here talking with a variety of dealers at the retail level, obviously there was tremendous shortages for both gold and silver products at the retail level. Took the mints a while to catch up. They're catching up at this point in time, is our assessment.
Right.
Did you see that same behavior in your individual clients? And secondarily, were there any shortages or delays in the large bar markets?
No, we didn't. We didn't experience any, and it seemed that the shortages, delays, and price increases in the large bar markets were in, you know, the East, Southeast Asia, and China, and so on. But it didn't seem to have happened here. But it depends on the size. At the time, we had, you know, we didn't have any large buyers. We did in our bars program, like we have the funds, but we also provide the large bars for sale and storage to high net worth investors. So we had some additional buying. We had a number that are in process that people realized that, you know, they held precious metals accounts in Switzerland that didn't own any precious metals actually. So that's been kind of what's been the evolving change.
All right. So talk me through what you think this final event will look like and how we'll detect it. And what I'm interested in here is sort of painting the picture for listeners that when this final moment comes, my view is that you either have your position in gold and silver or you don't. If you don't, you'll find yourself either priced out of the market or in the equivalent of like those bidding wars that happened for real estate when things really started to heat up and get tight, where you know you submit your bid and you get outbid by somebody else, and so you chase. And at any rate, I think my view is that gold and silver will be difficult to obtain at some point, potentially. How do you view that?
Absolutely. I think that particularly for the larger, you know, institutional buyers and high net worth investors, they have the biggest concern, and they need to get in as quickly as possible because they won't be able to get a decent allocation if they wait too long. I mean, the retail investor, you'll always be able to buy a coin or something like that at a premium, but if you had to buy tens of millions or 100 million or a billion, you're going to have a big problem. That even today would have to be done, carefully and carefully spaced. So it's not something you just, write a check for $1 billion and you've got your gold. That's not going to happen.
Right. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because the big institutional money and also the large family fund, endowment, pension, let's talk big money pools for a moment. What sort of ownership of gold exists in those at present?
Well, the statistics I've heard is that it's less than 0.5% of holdings on a retail level, and in the institutional level, if you combine mining stocks and physical bullion, it's less than 1%. So it's minimal. So all these discussions about the gold bubble is burst and it's all over and so on. Well, when that never was a bubble, and it didn't happen because it's so underowned, still today after, being the best performing asset class for the last, 11 years. So that's a long ways away from any kind of bubble territory. And this isn't going to be a bubble. It's not going to be like, the high-tech bubble that then, was based on irrational exuberance and bursts. This is going to be more like a, panic buying, to get rid of the worthless paper. That's not a bubble.
Right. Well, if we did have a gold bubble, it would be the first bubble in recorded human history which had fractional percentage participation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, so the gold bubble talk has always been silly to me because you can't, by definition, a bubble has mass participation, and we have not yet seen that in gold, at least in this country. But I want to talk now real quickly about, what I'm interested in is what the triggers might be that would lead to this next stage of gold's revaluation and normalization against currency. I hesitate to call it a big price rise in gold. Instead, it's going to be a sort of a remarking against existing currency. So one of the trigger points for me is I know that looking up through the mid-60s, late-60s, all of a sudden, the Bretton Woods agreements unraveling, and France and other countries are demanding their gold. In August 15th, 1971, Nixon has to slam the gold window. And that's because there had been this steady erosion and hemorrhaging of gold over time from U.S. possession. So fast forward, slightly analogous situation, I think, is that the entire West, which would include, basically all the OECD countries, but primarily it's going to be, New York and London, are busy telling us that gold is undervalued, and people in India and China in particular, but also Russia, other countries, seem to be saying yahoo, and they've been buying massive amounts of gold. I've been stunned at the numbers, hundreds and hundreds of tons per quarter, just going into these countries. And so it feels analogous to me that there's this now hemorrhaging and erosion of gold away from the West to the East. Is that something that you're observing, and do you think it's significant?
That's clear, because if you look at the last year's supply demand reports, like the North American demand is like a fraction of demand in other parts of the world. So it hasn't registered in North America, and particularly in Canada. That we've never had a currency crisis. People don't see that Canada has any, issues, and we don't have the huge unfunded liabilities that the U.S. has, and so on. So we're somewhat complacent here about the way things are. But when you look at the rest of the world, they're they're in varying degrees of dire straits in terms of, you know, debts, deficit, unsustainable positions. And that's where in my book I'm covering, like, I tried to distill it down to some macro trends that, you know, we can have all the noise and events and this might happen and that might happen, but there's some major trends that are happening that are not reversible. And one is that, you know, as the baby boomers are retiring, that's going to be a huge shift in terms of the effect on GDP and government revenues, because you're shifting from people contributing the economy to people taking away, and that's going to be a massive shift that started. I believe the numbers are something like 10,000 a day. So the deficits, as high as they are now, are going to grow exponentially. And, you know, you add Obama's Medicare to the equation, well, that's going to be a giant further rise as people need more and more medical care as they get older. So we've got that's an unstoppable train by itself. The issue of peak oil, there's talk of, you know, shale and this and that and the other thing, but talking about, you know, conventional oil has peaked and is in decline, and the other methods are going to be more expensive oil one way or another when it all gets done. The issue there is that other than printing money, rising oil prices are the only other thing that, you know, creates price inflation across the board in everything. So you've got that, you know, irreversible trend, and the other thing is that unemployment rate is going to, you know, it's systemic. Like the jobs have been outsourced overseas; they're not coming back. And, you know, when and if they do come back because of high oil prices, the manufacturers are going to be fully automated with robotics. It's not going to be a manual assembly line like it was when the people got laid off. So all these things put together, it just means, you know, lower GDP, lower tax revenues, higher deficits, you know, by the year. And just that simple correlation, you know, will get you to the $10,000 gold price.
And that's absent any sort of trigger or exogenous event or anything.
Oh, yeah, that's just progressing as is with all the existing knowns. I mean, there's many events, and they haven't gone away from, you know, when gold was 1900. They've all gotten worse. Nothing's been solved. Nothing's been cured. It isn't getting better. There's all this talk about inflation being under control, but that's still, you know, simply selective statistics over what reality is. John Williams has, you know, is more accurate in terms of what real inflation is, and it's closer to 10%. And at 10% in inflation, you've got huge negative real interest rates. That's totally unsustainable.
Well, let's talk about owning gold for a minute, because when you talk about the potential tailwinds for gold on just the fiscal recklessness side, also the monetary printing, we have events like Cyprus. And then all the noise that's come out first across Europe that potentially there's going to be bail-ins of depositor accounts, meaning that my personal faith and trust in the banking system has been eroded, because they basically said, "Hey, we're going to gamble with your money, and if we lose, we'll take your money." And then we saw even Canada come out and say that a bail-in was a possible way to deal with a systemic crisis. And the U.S. did it, and also New Zealand, and we're starting to see now lots of reasons to have loss of faith in institutions, MF Global, you name it. Talk to me about how you own gold in that environment where you can have the trust and confidence that your wealth will not be confiscated.
Well, first of all, you need to understand that, you know, I think the Cyprus situation, you know, brought things to light, but there's plenty of cases in the U.S. in terms of what a deposit is. When you just have a regular, you know, cash account and you deposit money, technically what you've done is you've lent the money to the bank. It's a loan, okay, that you could ask for repayment, but it's a loan. The money isn't being held in trust by the bank for you. It ceased to be your money when you deposited. It became the bank's money.
So you're a general creditor.
That's right. So we need to understand that in the first place. Secondly, to then, you know, avoid bank runs and so on. So then you have deposit insurance, and varies by country, but let's call it $100,000. After $100,000, that was never insured. So if a bank was to fail, everything over $100,000 that wasn't covered by insurance it is potentially lost, okay? Because you're just an unsecured creditor. So that's always been the case. This is not particularly new. There hasn't been an example where people have woken up to this, mm-hmm. but that's always been the case. If you have a gold account, then fundamentally that's no different. It doesn't matter whether, you know, it's a foreign currency account or a gold account or a silver account. They're all basically the same. So that's again, you're just a creditor. Okay, so they're not confiscating or stealing your gold. You never had any in the first place. In order to have an asset, you have to have a transfer of title. The same process it applies whether, you know, it's a house, a boat, a car, any tangible asset. The transaction has to, you know, describe the asset, and the vendor in the transaction transfers the asset to the purchaser, and that asset is described in detail. So that's how you buy bullion. In the case of bullion, you need a transfer of title. You need a document that gives you the refiner, the serial number, the exact weight and purity, and said, this bar with these details is now transferred to Chris. Mm-hmm. Then you own gold. But all these other things that people are worrying about is the issue that I tell people, well, you just haven't read the fine print. The banks aren't doing anything that they're not allowed to do under their agreements. Just read the agreement. Mm-hmm. You never owned any gold in the first place. So that's the issue. Once you own the gold, then you can enter into a custody agreement and put it into allocated storage. But it's your gold that you're putting in storage, and that's being held in trust. If the bank fails, that gold never was part of the assets of the bank.
Right.
They're storing it in trust for you. But you have to have clear title. If you can't show up with documentation to the bank regularity, trustee in bankruptcy, as the case may be, that proves that you actually own the gold, okay, then it's going to get into the unsecured creditor pool. So in order to save money, people have invested in or put their money into accounts, into certificates, thinking they own gold, but they never did. And they just needed to read the fine print, and that's the Cyprus situation. So on is becoming a surface, you know, the difference.
Well, we saw this also with MF Global. I believe there was at least one hedge fund I read about that believed it owned a bunch of gold that was part of its portfolio. And MF Global goes down, and all of a sudden that gold got sold out from under them as part of the general process, and that money was then pooled, and then they, you know, got in line with everybody else to see what proportion of the remaining pool would be divvied back to them. They were outraged because they actually had the warehouse receipts and said, this is ours, and even that wasn't good enough. Did you follow that story when it broke?
Well, I've looked at the MF Global story, and you know, it's amazing that, you know, nobody's getting prosecuted or being charged with everything, because there's a lot of issue. But I haven't read the fine print in that case. But MF Global was a futures trader, and probably when you have your futures account, you've allowed the futures dealer to hypothecate your gold or something of that order. If it's a clear, if you want to really own gold, like I say, it's a two-step process. You have to purchase the bullion, have proper documentation that transfers title to specific bars, and then you enter into a custody agreement, you know, that stores those bars on an allocated basis and identifies what the custodian can and can't do. But with those documents properly done, that there can't be any third-party claims or any, you know, bankruptcy issues with the custodian.
Right. So to those steps, I think you would also be looking at an institution that might hold your gold for you. Obviously, you'd want them insured, and you'd probably want to have third-party independent audits, just to be clear on all of that. Is there anything else that you'd want to be looking for?
Well, exactly. Once you own it, like, and when we've set that process up in terms of our bullion bars product to track all these issues, and we have various checks and balances to give the clients the transparency and the assurances that the bullion is there with their name on it, and so on and so forth. So, you know, we have audits for both our funds and the bars, so that's verified and so on. But even like in our case, like in the mutual fund, we have unallocated accounts and we have allocated storage of the bullion. And in our case, we need to have unallocated accounts to facilitate the day-to-day, purchases and redemptions of the fund.
Mm-hmm.
But when the unallocated accounts build up to the point where they're full bars, then we debit the unallocated accounts and move a full bar into the allocated storage. But that's what I'm saying. So if you're, you know, a hedge fund and you're doing trading, then in a lot of cases they don't move it into allocated storage. They keep their unallocated accounts as their trading accounts because it's very quick and easy to buy and sell out of an unallocated account, and there's no storage fees.
Right. Right. Well, and you may or may not own it, with emphasis on not.
In an unallocated account, you've simply got is essentially an IOU from your bank. But you know, we keep those amounts in our funds like to a very minimal percentage, you know, compared to the overall fund holdings.
All right. Well, the title of your book then, $10,000 Gold, can we turn briefly in the time we have to silver? Do you happen to, what are your views there, and do you happen to have a similar giant price target for silver in your story?
Well, silver has the potential, obviously, I think, to have a higher, you know, percentage rise. It's by, you know, all measures in terms of the gold-silver ratios, it's running at about plus or minus 50 to 1 right now, and there's been a lot of precedents, and you can make a lot of arguments that it should be 16 to 1. So as the gold price goes to 10,000, I think you'll have silver get closer to a more reasonable gold-silver ratio, as well as rise in it. So it will likely have a higher percentage increase than gold will.
All right. Well, the title of your book, $10,000 Gold, Why Gold's Inevitable Rise is the Investor's Safe Haven. We've been talking with Nick Barashev, President and CEO of Bullion Management Group. Nick, if people want to find out more about your writings beyond the book, how would they do that?
Well, they can go to our website and just look up bmgbullion.com, and we have, you know, from there, we have separated now into two websites, one for the mutual fund and one for the bullion bars. So a lot of the articles, everything are all posted there, and we have a number of reports people can download, and also have a free newsletter that they can subscribe to. So all that's available on the site.
Well, absolutely. I would advise anybody listening, get the book, read it, and you want the history, you want the context, you want the background, because this is a time when all that context will reassert itself. It always does. The four most dangerous words in investing are this time it's different. It turns out it's never different, and gold has a very profound story to tell. And really, it's actually the story of how fiat currencies always seem to follow the same general pattern for very human reasons. And so humans are still humans, and we're probably going to see history repeat itself in some fashion. And this will be extraordinary because this time it's global, and that is kind of a new wrinkle in the story, but it's not really different at heart. So the book, $10,000 Gold, author's Nick Baryshev. Nick, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris, anytime.